Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Zero to Agile. This is your host, Phil Gipixi. This is a continuation of our last episode where I was talking with Pete Brown and Rachel Pell, both Microsoft senior evangelists, about how they get to know their customer. Before we get back into the interview, I do want to call out that we have set up a new Twitter account at Zero to Agile. So if you'd like to leave us comments or talk to us via Twitter, please feel free. We'd love to hear from you. Now, back to the interview.
Well, and that's certainly, you know, the people that are on Twitter and are active on your blogs and things like that are certainly the vocal minority, right? And I think the problem that everybody has in getting information is from that silent majority, right? The 9-to-5 developers, as you called them earlier, Pete, the people who, you know, they're doing their job, go home, turn the computer off, and don't think about it again until the next morning. But that's probably a significant number of developers, and you still have to be able to enable them to become better at their jobs too, right? So what approaches do you have to try and reach those people?
Yeah, there's, of course, like, you know, just feet on the pavement, you know, going to where they are. Something too about the vocal majority, or the vocal minority rather, which is more like an angry mob sometimes. What'll happen is we'll go out and, you know, I'll sit, or like at a conference now, after each session, I just did an orchard talk and, you know, talk to several people up on the stage. You give out your business card, you get them. Sometimes they have a problem or something, and, you know, you're going to communicate with them later about it to help them out, stuff like that. And often those, you know, the 9-to-5ers will say, you know, hey, we would really like this. This would be easy to do this way or that way. But then you'll get the vocal minority that's usually the alpha dogs and the, you know, early adopters and all that. And sometimes what'll happen is they'll be like, no, we want to do it this way. And, you know, there becomes a clash. And sometimes it's, you know, a certain customer segment and another one almost are fighting, except that they're not fighting at each other. They're both bringing different perspectives to us. And then what happens is we do things like we have Visual Studio for the pro dev. And now we have Web Matrix where a pro dev can use it, but a hobbyist can too. And just doing the Web Matrix and Orchard talks, you know, I got a mix of both in there. And, you know, some of the pro devs are like, ew, Web Matrix is too, you know, slimmed down. Well, if you're doing a huge software engineering, you know, mission critical app, maybe you just shouldn't use it, right? Sometimes they don't kind of understand that. We do have the other customers, and trying to help them understand that that's why we have this broad range of products is sometimes very difficult.
And the hard thing with that is, a lot of times, you know, the reason why we think of them sometimes as the alpha devs, they, other people will look to them for their opinions.
Exactly.
And they're so they'll poo-poo something like, say, Web Matrix. I'm not saying that that's happened, but they will.
Or Web Forms.
Yeah.
They get to poo-poo all the time.
No real developer would ever use product X. And then
Lightswitch, right? Because we've heard that a few times.
Yeah. And so these other developers who are looking for guidance from somebody will say, like, well, you know, this highly respected developer there said no real developer would ever use that, so I'm not even going to look at it. But that is targeted exactly at somebody like that has to get the job done and has to do it quickly and doesn't have years and years of experience, or quite honestly, you know, in many cases, you know, a soapbox to stand on just to, you know, get an opinion out there, right? So that sounds a little negative against the alpha folks, which most, you know, a lot of them are very good friends of mine. So I don't mean it that way. Just that they are an audience that is not representative of the whole, just like the 9-to-5 folks are not representative of the whole either. And we need to balance that. And you asked about like how you reach some of these folks. I've actually found that for the 9-to-5 developers, you know, there's code camps and stuff, you'll get a certain amount of those. But that's why I've written a couple of books now, because these are the people that are going to store and buying a book to learn the stuff.
That's true. You know, actually, like, as a consultant, everywhere I went, books were on people's cubes.
Yeah. So, you know, I've written a few Silverlight books now. I'm working on a Windows 8 book, and it's really targeted towards those people that need to get a job done and also gain some insight. And the audience of people that buy my book and the audience of people I talk to on Twitter and stuff there, you know, if you looked at them as a Venn diagram, there's only a little sliver there in the middle. Like, mm-hmm. It's really, a very different group of people.
So that's interesting. So you're actually using or trying to use your books as almost like a gateway drug in the communication channels. to try and get them, because that's certainly one way communication, right?
Right.
I mean, you write a book and saying here's the best practices, and it will help them become better developers, but that doesn't necessarily help you know them.
No, no.
Right? It just gets the information to them that they wouldn't get another way.
Right. And that doesn't really fit like sort of what you've been asking about here, like how to get to know your customers. In that case, in many cases, that's the best we can do is at least help them succeed. And we'll hear some feedback from them about things. And sometimes I do hear feedback from books, and you know, I'll go to a conference and people will recognize me, not from anything I've ever done online, but the fact that I wrote, you know, a 1200 page book, right? And then I'll get some feedback from them there that sort of gives them an opening. But in many cases, it's very simply, sorry, the bomb's gonna go off. It is more of a one-way communication, and you can infer some things about those developers, but you know, we don't really know them, and I don't even know to lay it all on the table. I don't even know that Microsoft necessarily really knows these people either, because they're not participating in anything. Like, we know kind of what they do in Visual Studio and what they buy and things like that, but
they can only buy what we put out.
Right. I mean, do we know what they really want and what they really need? Not really. Not unless they come and tell us.
Right. Well, and we do have. At least in DPE or Developer Platform Evangelism, an enterprise group which works closely with sales. So of course, you know, like we try to stay away from there as much as possible. But the enterprise people would have field engineers and consultants and stuff like that. They work with MCS and all that. Yeah. So those people are in the enterprise shops
and even MCS
the
being shop. Microsoft Consulting Services.
Yeah.
Feet on the ground.
So they're in there actually doing the work, and they're probably actually our closest contacts with those people.
True.
However, at least for me, I'm what's called an audience evangelist. So I just kind of, you know, scattershot at whoever, anybody, which I guess is kind of like you too, audience. So they focus, you know, on a couple big accounts or something like that. Now, the cool thing is, being that they're on a different team, they still ask for resources, or they'll ask, they'll say, hey, they're looking at MVC and they already have a lot of web forums. You want to come and, you know, do a live meeting, or, you know, stop in downtown. I was at Credit Suisse with another evangelist, Dave Zbitsky, and we did a nice little thing for them about HTML and Silverlight and all that stuff, and no fighting or anything like that. Okay, so we did that, and you know, so that went very well. So we do back up and support the enterprise accounts, but we can't, or at least I can't, focus all of my time there. The nice thing for me is to make contacts to our consultants who are working with those people,
right.
And stuff like that.
You're right. Especially MCS, you're right, because we do get a lot of feedback from those folks. And we have internal mailing lists. Like, for example, there's an internal Silverlight discussion list. And a lot of the people that are on that are consultants that are out there at client sites, and these are the problems they have. So we do get, I won't say it's direct feedback, it's kind of indirect feedback, but it's much better than Rachel or I could gather ourselves, I think, from these customers. And that gets you a lot further down there. Same thing with talking, a lot of these alpha developers that we talk to, many of them are consultants, and they can tell you what's going on at their client sites, but sometimes you really have to ask the questions to get that out of them. But I do find the MCS folks will come to you with questions. So.
Yeah, and well, the MCS, of course, they're under, you know, billables and, you know, the requirements that they have for their job and stuff like that. And they're usually, like, having a problem right then and there. And they'll be like, hey, can you help me with this problem? And, like, say, sure I can, right? So we do, and then now we know that here's something that would be a great feature for this customer out of this discussion. So that's always some positive things. Now, back to the, like, the alpha dogs. You know, they might be consulting and seeing the same thing. However, the fact that they usually would kind of lean toward one side of more heavy engineering, or, you know, doing something like that. And while I'm all for that, you know, sometimes the client doesn't necessarily, or those 9-to-5ers behind them don't necessarily want that. So they'll just kind of give you how they would have done it anyway. Sometimes you just can't do it the way you want to, right? And that's probably the worst thing, is being a consultant, because I was a consultant for many years before Microsoft, is, you know, the client has certain restrictions. You have to work within those.
Yeah.
And then, of course, those restrictions are the things that we need as, you know, Microsoft folks to become features later, so that it can alleviate the restrictions or work with them.
Right.
You know,
right.
Things like that.
Yeah, when I was a consultant before Microsoft as well, it was the same thing. You go into a client site and we'd be on product X and they're on X minus two, you know, in their organization for multiple reasons, and they have certain security restrictions, and they need to support these integration with these services. And by the way, they've got a big hunk of iron in the corner that all their transactions have to go through and other stuff. So those are definitely very real world situations that you only know when you get in there and talk to the people that have to live that every day.
Yeah, actually, recently I asked some folks in a talk not too long ago, and I said, like, seriously, how many still have a Pentium, like, 486 in a corner?
A Pentium 4, right? Not
Pentium
a 486.
Four. Oh, sorry, Pentium 4 or like, older.
8088.
Anything, Commodore 64. Yeah. Pete has several Commodores, but that's different. But something in a closet or, you know, tucked away in the corner, and it runs an app, and it's still running that app for 20 years ago, and that's, like, the only app that runs on it. You know, people are still dealing with this kind of stuff, you know, like a DOS-based app. See, and a good deal of people do have that kind of stuff out there.
So last year I met with some people that I used to work with. Before I was a consultant, I was the whole computer department at this medical billing company in Massachusetts. And this was like 92 era, right? And I had built this application in Delphi 1.0, you know, Pascal type stuff. You know, first it had like the Borland database engine, which was dog slow, ran on 16-bit Windows.
I remember that.
Right. And so this person told me, he's like, yeah, we're still maintaining that application. And I was just boggled. It's almost 20 years old, you know, this application. Yeah. You guys are still running it? Oh, yeah, we still give it to our customers. And I had this special program that I created that created special security keys that it put on the 3.5-inch floppy for the install so that it would only be registered to them, and they're still using it.
I think to replace the floppies would cost more than the program at this point.
It was amusing to find all that stuff out there.
And you guys typically find out about those things to hardware, though, right?
Oh, during my talk today, the last talk I gave today, I was jokingly, I said, yeah, so how many of you are still writing VB6 applications? Ha, ha, ha.
More than half the room will.
More than an octopus worth of arms, right? Or like raising their hand in that room. And I was like, wow. And I just thought it was funny. I was like, wow, the people still running XP have somebody to laugh at because these people are still building stuff that's even older than that.
Yeah. It's still tons of classic ASP out there too, all that stuff. Yeah.
Now, when you get information like that, right, you know, however many people raise their hands, it's good to know and needs to be passed on. Do you guys have channels for that?
So, do you want to go?
There's no formal channels that I have, but usually what happens is we'll talk to the team, like I'll say to the ASP.NET team, so, hey guys, I have a bunch of people still doing classic ASP, and they're the direct, you know, product team for that, so I'll let them know or something like that. I don't know, you might have a more, being that you're in corp, you might have more of a formal thing.
Yeah, so that's probably one distinction is so your field, and you actually have an organization sitting above you on that, right? And we're all the same company, right? But sometimes the reporting structures make a big difference. So my group falls under DevDiv, and so I tend to have a little bit more open channels with some of the other groups. And so, for example, when I spoke at the last VS Live, and I was seeing a trend from several different conferences that nobody knew about MSDN and nobody knew about these other sites, I provide that feedback directly into the rest of the group, right? Because that's part of my larger organization in EPX.
And EPX is
Enabling Platform Experience, right? So it used to stand for something else, but we kept the acronym and changed the letters, or changed the word. So I provided that to them. Also, I got some feedback about, hey, you know, X percent of customers are still using Windows Forms, and I'll provide that over to the engineering teams. I had some things that I provided to Guthrie's group at one point because it seemed appropriate for them. So I'll send this stuff directly to different product groups, you know, as appropriate. And then we usually formalize it in some sort of it's just an email that gets sent out as a trip report and has, you know, here's where we spoke, here's how many people were roughly there. If we get the scores back in time, you know, a lot of conferences, you don't get the scores for a while. We'll put that in there as well and say, here's how it seemed the audience broke down. Hey, I gave this talk, I had about 150 people, roughly 50% of the developers were Windows Forms developers. And, you know, only like 5 or 6 people were connecting with us on Twitter. And only, you know, X number of people seemed to have any idea about these other online properties and whatnot. And where that actually gets rolled into, we take this specific example of not being aware of the online properties we have for help. There's a couple of things that gets rolled into. One, I had sent a message out to some of the East Coast DPE folks saying, hey, you know, it would really help if when you talk to customers, you remind them that we have these StarNet sites and MSDN and a bunch of other stuff. Just bring it up as a thing saying, hey, these are our online sites where you can find tutorials and a bunch of other stuff, as well as providing that to some of the engineering side of EPX when they start looking at how to better get these things integrated with search engines and how to better surface them on our sites. And then finally, on the content side, we're saying either the content's no good and people are ignoring it, or they're not aware it's there, but you should at least know that you're not getting the eyeballs from this group of people. And so we try to spread that out as much as possible. And it ends up, sometimes it's just a data point, but other times it tends to be fairly actionable stuff. You know, if I get feedback like, hey, customer, you know, I had X number of customers come up to me at the end of this talk and they were concerned about why. And I'll explain that to people. And a lot of times there's like, yeah, we know about why, but nevertheless, it helps to understand that people are at this conference and this is their main concern. And this is what's important to them.
Yeah. And I would think that might elevate the priority of that concern if, you know, the product teams are getting that feedback that, you know, spoke at X number of conferences and at 50% of them, this was their main concern. I would think that would really help.
Yeah.
Get that elevated up.
I can't speak to the specifics of it, but I have taken feedback from things like this and I have sent them around internally, and I have actually been able to get real changes made. And I don't say that to boost myself, but just in general, let people know that the feedback that customers provide us at events like this,
it does get heard.
It gets heard, and it actually gets heard at some fairly high levels. And you can say, I know you think X, but hey, this is what actual people who use our products on a day-to-day basis and I don't want to say their lives depend on it, but it's certainly their livelihoods depend on these products here. And this is what they're saying. And it's really hard to argue with actual customer testimonial.
Yeah.
Like, before I worked at Microsoft, there was somebody who was on a product team. And I remember him telling me, and I'm not going to tell you who it was, he's like, hey, if he sort of sidebar whispered to me, if that's really important to you, you tell these people that it's important to you, because I've been saying it all along, but as a Microsoft employee, nobody's listening to me. They're interested in what the customer has to say, you know?
Yeah, definitely has to come from the customer. Yeah, I would share the same thing as Pete. You know, some of it comes down to if you have good relationships with certain team members or if you know people or not. So, you know, if it's ASP.NET, if I just send them an email, usually they'll say, hey, we know about it, or we don't, or, you know, they'll do something. They may not be able to just go and change the code right away, but they at least have the awareness. And, you know, they know whether or not they can do something about it.
That's actually a good point about changing the code, because sometimes we'll get feedback and people don't realize the product cycles that we run under.
Like, they think that within 5 minutes of you finding out, it can be implemented and rolled out.
Well, they don't realize that the features are baked well ahead of time of when it actually ships. And the last, you know, half of a product cycle is the stabilization and the internationalization and getting things synchronized up with other products. And I know people talk about other, like, vendors being able to be a little more agile sometimes, but a lot of times they don't have to support all the different types of customers that we have to, and have to have all that stability there. So our product cycle tends to be more heavily weighted on the end for all this stabilization stuff.
Yeah.
And so I feel bad when we get feature requests a month before something ships, because 2.5 months ago or 3 months ago, it was done, you know, and 2 months before that or a year before that, the features were locked in, you know, so.
Yeah, that's sometimes the hardest thing too, is sometimes there's a change or something that somebody wants. And, you know, somebody will say, hey, look, why doesn't it do X, Y, Z? And I might know why, and I could tell them why, and say, here's why. And I'll be like, but I don't like that, and I would like to do it this other way. Well, sometimes it just simply is not going to happen that way, right? And then having to relay that is never, you know, a pleasant thing. But
and some of the more agile projects tend to be the ones that are, I'm not going to say that they're agile because they're open source, but they're open source because they can be agile and because they don't necessarily have to have the same burden that a lot of the other products that are part of like a large ship train have to have. So if you take stuff like MicroFrameworks, one that I'm very interested in, that's open source Apache license, and we take community contributions and people can directly manipulate that. A lot of the stuff that the WCF folks have worked on is available out there as open source, and they're able to iterate on it faster because they make the interim builds available to people. Right. And because the customers using that specific thing are okay with dealing with stuff that's sort of half done and maybe not fully baked yet. You can't do the same thing with Word. Right. You know, I mean, you can't release, I would say there would be a lot of upset people if you released sort of the open source version of Word out there, right, that was half baked and they started using it. And hey, you know, by the way, every once in a while it deletes your document, right? So, because it's just not completely done yet, right? But for some projects, it works really well. In those cases, I think we've done a pretty decent job of being more agile about it.
Yeah, I think, well, it's the same thing. Going open source, a lot of customers had talked about, you know, we're never huge on open source until not terribly long ago. So we have heard, you know, and let people participate. Of course, you know, who's going to participate? Most likely that's, again, going to be those early adopters or the alpha dog type, you know, are the ones participating. But in most all my talks, especially like now Orchard, which is all open source, I'm like, hey, you guys, you make a theme, package it up and stick it up there for other people. Or if you make a module, you know, unless you have some IP that you can't, you know, allow out, why not just stick it up there and package it for other people? You know, or for yourself later, you know, when you go somewhere else or to work on a different project or whatever.
Yeah.
So you have that kind of stuff. So open source is an interesting way to work with the customers that way. The out-of-band roles of the, you know, like NuGet and other products out of Studio is interesting because a lot of folks really do like that. Like Pete said, just being able to take those, maybe they're half-baked and you're well aware of it, right? You know, lets you know really quickly that, you know, it's not a complete product. And then you get the others that are willing to wait for the ship cycle, right? So that's nice.
This episode of Zero to Agile is brought to you by Telerik Team Pulse. Incorporating customer feedback into your development process is essential if you want to produce software that meets customer expectations and deadlines. Now, you can easily do that with Telerik's Agile project management tool, Team Pulse, with this extension, the Ideas and Feedback Portal. The portal is a web-based solution that connects product teams with their customers and partners. There, they can submit feedback about projects and collaborate on it by leaving comments and voting. Then this customer feedback can easily be transformed into concrete work items such as stories and tasks. Thanks to this rapid feedback loop, your development team will always be able to build the right features in the right order at the right time and increase customer value. Make sure you give the Ideas and Feedback Portal a try at www.telerik.com/feedback-portal. That's telerik.com/feedback-portal. Thank you again to Telerik Team Pulse for sponsoring Zero to Agile and making this podcast possible. And now, back to the show.
Well, I think you get direct feedback, right? If people get to play with the bits and maybe even, you know, contribute, maybe not submit a patch. You know, I know there's some different rules around how that works. But they're having an impact. And anytime you let somebody have an impact, I think they're more likely to come back,
right,
and give you more feedback,
right?
If they think it's fallen on deaf ears. Like if you had, you know, a bunch of people come up to you at these conferences and they all had this prevailing complaint and you never addressed it, they're going to be like, well, why should I talk to him anyway? Because he just ignores me.
Right.
Right. And that doesn't mean that you can always satisfy that need, but you can at least address it.
But I will say, though, that the people, it's a weird thing where we have to understand, even on the open source projects, we're dealing with a segment of the developer population, just like Rachel was saying, that they're probably the alpha types there. Not necessarily, it's not a one-to-one, but chances are that they're more like that than they are like 9-to-5 developer. Also because a lot of people that work at companies, salaried employees, still have restrictions where they can't contribute to open source projects.
That's right? True.
So, I mean, so that can be kind of hard to do as well. Like, I know at Microsoft, anything that's over X lines of code, we need to make sure legal says, yeah, it's okay for us to release that as open source, just to make sure there isn't some random piece of IP in there that they need to be concerned about.
Yeah.
But otherwise, we're told, yeah, you know, you can go ahead and do open source stuff, right? But I know a lot of companies still haven't gotten to that point yet. So it's not even just Microsoft's not doing open source. It's that a lot of our customers still aren't ready for it, you know? I mean, and that's by no means an excuse, right? Because we can always do more there, but it's just not for everybody.
And one of the advantages of getting those early adopters involved in your product cycle early is, yeah, they're going to help shape the product, at least for their needs.
Yeah.
But they're going to work out the kinks. They're going to work out the bugs. They're going to work out the, you know, even just like from user experience issues, those types of things. And it'll become a better product. And if you look at something like MVC, which the early adopters were certainly the alpha dogs, right?
Right.
The people who were doing Rails and that type of stuff. And
right.
They really wanted the MVC framework. And I sat at a lunch table with a bunch of guys that had never looked at MVC, but they knew they were feeling pain in web forms, right? So these guys are not early adopters.
Right.
Right. And they had a lot of questions about, I think we need to move to MVC. So then you start getting that feedback from the other people because it's safe, right? Or it's perceived to be safe.
Right, right.
All right.
Yeah, it's interesting how that works where, like, even when we release some things out of band, like, we have some really good code on the code gallery on MSDN, which is a little bit different from CodePlex. It can't be quite open source, but we still want to release it and all that stuff. But companies are often afraid to incorporate that in because their policies don't allow them to use something that's not shrink-wrapped. I mean, and that's why a lot of people say, you know, this particular database access technology or ORM or something is already out there. Why is Microsoft shipping something else? And a lot of times because we have to. If we don't ship something else, you know, there is a large segment of the population that will have nothing.
Right.
And the other cases, like, it's really great that we're able to ship jQuery with Visual Studio 2, because at least we didn't have to go and recreate that, and we're still able to provide it. And it's amazing for, again, a segment of the population, and probably not the listeners of this podcast, but a segment of the population where if it comes in the box, then it's safe and it's okay and I can use it. And if it doesn't come in the box, then it's like, I'm not sure about that.
Right, right.
But at the end of the day, that's some of the customers, right?
Yeah. Quite a few.
Why
quite
Microsoft
a few.
Is doing some of the things. I guess I don't work for or speak for Microsoft, but, you know, I've heard that a lot of the spaces that Microsoft's moving into, it's not just, like you said, not just duplicating technology because we want to be Microsoft and we want to have, you know, one of everything in the world.
Right.
It's to satisfy those customers that can't bring in, you know, some of the open source stuff or some of the smaller pieces.
And that actually brings up a point of, we're reaching out to new customer bases that are more consumer oriented and are more, you know, the hobbyist students out of college, kids wanting to, or adults, whatever, wanting to write apps, throw them out on Windows Phone, or do some web apps and get a site up and running and do whatever, you know, they want to do to make money online or, you know, through other software projects. So a lot of these things, you know, if you're making like a little tic-tac-toe game for, you know, the phone, for Windows Phone 7, you know, again, that's how much engineering do you need to have? What is going to, you're going to refund somebody their 99 cents at worst.
It's like the design is much more important than the architecture.
Than the architecture anymore, yeah. And so now we actually see a lot, I work with a lot more students now as well than I used to. And a lot of it is because they're getting a lot into the web. They're doing web matrix. Some are comp sci grads, so they want to go right in a studio. But getting a lot of those too, and a lot of hobbyists. So that's, you know, sometimes those different broad categories of customers do clash like that, right? And it's, again, just balancing it all with the different products we have and taking the feedback back to make them better for everyone.
Well, and I think we've now introduced another type of customer that we're talking about, especially, Pete, when you were talking about the different applications. The people on the phones are not your customer, but the customer of your customer, right?
Right.
Because the people writing the apps are writing it for them. And if they had better knowledge of their customers, then they could know, you know, what's the worst thing that happens if this call center app crashes?
Right.
So, you know, I think one of the things that we have to do as software engineers and agile coaches and whatever we're doing is make sure that not only are we taking into account our direct customers, which in your cases are the devs, but help them realize that they need to think about their customers as well. And it could very, very, it could end up with very different decisions on how you develop things. All right. Well, I think we've had a great conversation, and I really appreciate your insights into how you guys, you know, get to know your customers better. Is there any final things you'd like to add?
So I would say that I think Rachel and I here have been like really candid on this, and in case it comes across as there's like any customer segment we dislike or think differently, so I understand that we recognize that they're all our customers, and we come to things like this specifically because we're looking to reach different kinds of customers. Right. We go to like a build and we participate online because we like to talk to all of these different types of people and get to know them. So understand that we weigh things differently based not on who you are, but sort of just like, you know, who that feedback represents in terms of numbers of customers and stuff and circumstances them. And everything. But we certainly have a lot of respect for all of our customers.
Yes. Yeah, just to reiterate what Pete said, you know, we do, like, all of our customers are important, of course, like, should be for any company. So we definitely want to reach them. But, you know, sometimes it's just, I mean, it's like one little person and there's all these folks out there in the web, and I feel like I want to get to them all now. A little bit impossible, but.
Well, great. So we'll have your blogs and bios and everything up in the show notes so people can get a hold of you. And really appreciate you guys taking time off your schedules to come chat with us about how to get to know your customer. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you for listening. If you have any comments, concerns, or suggestions, you can reach out to us at telerik.com/zerotoagile. Follow us on Twitter at @zerotoagile. Or send us an email at zerotoagile@telerik.com. See you next time. Thank you.